Let's go ahead and open our Bibles back to the book of Hosea today. Hosea chapter number 10. Hosea is a prophet of the 8th century BC, and the section of his book that we're looking at right now, probably written right around the 740s, maybe into the 730s, as the northern kingdom is coming closer and closer to its end. God has told them now that they've crossed over the line of no return. They are going to suffer for their sins. And this document is basically the document outlining why this is all going to happen. It's written by a man who has experienced what it feels like to be married to someone that constantly cheats on you, just like Israel is constantly cheating on God. And so let's continue with the prophetic warnings of Hosea to northern Israel and sometimes to southern Judah. Chapter 10, verse 1. Israel is a luxuriant vine that yields its fruit. The more his fruit increased, the more altars he built. As his country improved, he improved his altars, or his pillars. Their heart is false, now they must bear their guilt. He who is will break down their altars and destroy their pillars. So they have taken the blessings of God in the promised land and turned them into resources for worshiping other gods and goddesses. So in accordance with the covenant, as outlined in the book of Deuteronomy, God is going to come in and destroy all of that, kick them out of their land, and leave them in a situation where they're going to have to think about why all this happened, and a remnant will hopefully come out of this repentant, ready to return to the land. Verse number 3, for now they will say, we have no king, for we do not fear he who is. And a king, what could he do for us? The prophets always reminded the people that God was their king. The Ark of the Covenant was his throne. The temple at Jerusalem, before that, the tabernacle, was his throne room and his entrance hall or his audience hall. And yet these people are saying, God's not our king. And even if we reject him as such, what's he going to do? Can he do something to help us at all? Well, verse 4 says, they utter mere words. With empty oaths, they make covenants. So judgment springs up like a poisonous weed in the furrows of the field. A lot of metaphors going on here. So they're out making false oaths, and they end up bringing judgment on themselves because they're basically planting sin. And that is coming back as a harvest of poisonous weeds. The inhabitants of Samaria tremble for the calf of Beth Aven. Beth Aven means in Hebrew the house of vanity or the house of emptiness. It's probably a derisive term for Beth El, the place where the golden calf temple is. And so these guys have been worshiping God in that form ever since they broke away from southern Judah. Verse 5 continues, its people mourn for it, and so do its idolatrous priests, those who rejoiced over it and over its glory, for it has departed from them. The thing itself shall be carried to Assyria as tribute to the great king. Ephraim shall be put to shame. Israel shall be ashamed of his idol. So prophetically, it is revealed that the golden calf, the original one I think we're talking about, is going to be hauled off as tribute to the victorious king of Assyria. By that time, it'll be Shalmaneser, the replacement for Tiglath-Pileser III. And Israel will be shamed because of all these years, these centuries of their worship of this idol. Verse 7, Samaria's king shall perish like a twig on the face of the waters. So the king will die during the invasion of Assyria. The high places of Avon, the sin of Israel, shall be destroyed. Thorn and thistle shall grow up on their altars, and they shall say to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us. So Bethel itself and the temple of the golden calf going to be turned into ruins, and those ruins are going to be overgrown. And the picture here is of those ruins basically calling to the mountains, you need to just come in and cover us over. You just make us disappear from sight. Now, interestingly enough, that phrase, they shall say to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us, gets grabbed by Jesus as a reference to what will happen to the people caught up in the judgment of the day of the Lord. They will wish that they didn't have to be seen by Jesus, by God coming in judgment. It also shows up again in the book of Revelation, same context, that as the day of the Lord progresses, some of the people will think they can hide from judgment by begging for the mountains to come over the top of them. But the fact of the matter is, you cannot hide from God's judgment. Verse 9. From the days of Gibeah you have sinned, O Israel. Remember, that's a reference back to something from the period of the Judges, when such sin took place in the city of Gibeah that the other tribes of Israel came against the city and they almost wipe out the entire tribe of Benjamin. And a whole bunch of other Israelis die as well from the other tribes, because there was just so much sin that God allowed them to fight amongst themselves and judgment to come in that fashion. So God is warning that they've been at this sort of sinful behavior from the very beginning of their existence in the land. There they have continued. Shall not the war against the unjust overtake them in Gibeah? So they are going to have problems when the Assyrians invade all the way down to the southernmost portion of the northern kingdom, because Gibeah was like right on the borderland between northern Israel and southern Judah. Verse 10, when I please, I will discipline them, and nations shall be gathered against them when they are bound up for their double iniquity. So they're going to get trouble from all directions when God's judgment comes. Verse 11, Ephraim was a trained calf that loved to thresh, and I spared her fair neck. So God kind of portrays Israel in its earlier years as his pet calf that loved to pull the threshing sledge. But God was kind and left it alone until it started misbehaving. And now that they've misbehaved, this is what happened. But I will put Ephraim to the yoke. So I'm going to bring them under the yoke of my judgment. And then Judah must plow. Jacob must harrow for himself. So it's not just going to be northern Israel that's going to suffer. Southern Judah is also going to feel the sting of God's judgment. As I reminded you repeatedly, when the Assyrians sweep down into the Middle East at God's direction, they will bring great disaster on many, many, many nations. And they will take a lot of those nations into exile. But Judah will lose some fortified cities. They will have some trouble because of the a Syrian invasion, but God will protect them from being sent into exile. The city of Jerusalem will not be harmed. The temple will not be touched. But they will know that what happens to them is from the Lord. And this is one of the passages to remind them of that. And then this is what they're told. Sow for yourselves righteousness. Reap steadfast love. Break up your fallow ground. For it is the time to seek he who is, that he may come and rain righteousness upon you. So we've seen this agricultural language, this symbolism before, where northern Israel in particular was planting poisonous seeds, and because of that, they were reaping this bad harvest of judgment. You might remember that they sowed the wind and they reaped the whirlwind. So this is the recommendation in that same vein as to how they can have a good harvest of righteousness. Well, they have to sow righteousness because you're going to reap what you sow. You have to sow righteousness so that you can reap God's love. And you need to break up that fallow ground. Think about Jesus' parable of the different soils. The reason that the seed couldn't get into the first soil was because it was hard packed. So you've got to plow that up in order to make it possible for the seed to get in there. So in this instance, God is recommending that they need to plow up their hard hearts to let the righteous seed of God get inside of them. And we need to encourage that in other people around us as well. For they've got to seek God. They've got to want a relationship. And then he's going to bring the rain that will let the crops grow and bring the crops to their fruition. That rain is his own Holy Spirit work. And so all of us have got to be involved in every step of this cycle that will bring the harvest of righteousness. Otherwise, we're going to end up with the same mess that the northern Israelis did. Verse 13, you've plowed iniquity, you've reaped injustice, you've eaten the fruit of lies. So that's what happens if you don't follow God's advice. Because you've trusted in your own way and in the multitude of your warriors. Therefore, the tumult of war shall arise among your people. All your fortresses shall be destroyed. So northern Israel is going to suffer greatly. A lot of people are going to die. A lot of property is going to be destroyed and damaged. Then a little historical reference. As Shalmon destroyed Beth Arbel on the day of battle, mothers were dashed in pieces with their children. Now, historically, we don't know for sure who this guy is. He may be related to a historical figure from the near past at this time that had attacked this particular place, and in the process, killed a lot of women and children. The reason it's brought up is because it's recent enough history that the people will remember that, and they were appalled by it. Verse 15, thus it shall be done to you, O Bethel, because of your great evil. At dawn, the king of Israel shall be utterly cut off. So because of their sins, they also are going to see great deals of death and destruction, even on the women and children. Chapter number 11. This first verse is quoted in the Christmas story of the book of Matthew. And the way that Matthew uses it is that when Joseph and Mary took little Jesus down to Egypt, they stayed there until Herod had died and God's angel told them to return. And so they came back to the promised land out of Egypt. And then Matthew says, this was to fulfill that which was spoken by the prophet. He was talking about Hosea. Out of Egypt I have called my son. So here's the way that the original passage is written, the context it's in. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. So Matthew applies that to Jesus, the Son of God, coming out of Egypt. But it was originally written as a historical reminder that God looked at the people of Israel as his firstborn son, as his beloved child that was in Egypt, and he brought them out of there because he loved them. But then what happened? Verse 2. The more they were called, the more they went away. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and burning offerings to idols. So God is loving Israel, the seed of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And yet, as much as he loves them, they keep cheating on him. They keep sacrificing to the various variations of Baal, the pagan thunder and lightning god. Verse 3, yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them up by their arms, but they did not know that I healed them. So God's complaint in this portion of this lawsuit, because that's what this is, it's a lawsuit complaint against Israel, is that he kept doing good things for them, kept trying to help them grow up, and they repaid him by ignoring him or even actively rebelling against him. Verse 4, I led them with cords of kindness and with the bands of love, and I became to them as one who eases the yoke on their jaws, and I bent down and fed them. You remember how Jesus said, come to me, all you who are burdened and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you, because my yoke is easy. So here is God in the Old Testament saying, I'm the one that tried to help Israel have an easy time of it. I bent over backwards, helping to feed them and raise them. And what did they do in return? They treated me with contempt and rejection. And so, because of that, judgment is coming. Verse 5. They shall not return to the land of Egypt, but Assyria shall be their king because they refuse to return to me. So God says, I'm not going to make the entire group of them go back to Egypt, even though they kind of deserve to go back there. Now, some of them, as we've already read, will go to Egypt, but it'll be by way of the Assyrian invasion. So here in verse 5, he says, I'm not going to send them as a nation back to Egypt. I'm going to send them to Assyria. And the Assyrian will be their king, because they apparently don't want me as their king. Verse 6, the sword shall rage against their cities, consume the bars of their gates, and devour them because of their own counsels. A lot of people are going to die during the Assyrian invasion. My people are bent on turning away from me, and though they call out to the Most High, he shall not raise them up at all. Now, as is often the case, people who have no use for God in their normal day-to-day life, in fact, they are sometimes very contemptuous of him. The moment they fall on hard times, they start crying out for his assistance. They start begging for him to intervene and help them. And that's what God anticipates that these guys are going to do. The moment the invasion reaches the area where these people are at, they're going to start begging for the Most High to help him out, and he is not going to help because they didn't want it before. Verse 8, doesn't make God happy though. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboim? Now, if you don't remember those names, those are two of the other cities of the plain that were destroyed with Sodom and Gomorrah. My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. So God does not take pleasure in the death of the wicked. God does not get happy over bringing judgment against the people of Israel, against anyone. But they've given him no choice. But he doesn't have to totally annihilate all hope. Verse 9, I will not execute my burning anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not a man, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come in wrath. So there is a promise here inside the threat that there is hope inside the disaster, because there is going to be a remnant that will survive this invasion, that will go into Assyrian exile, and a portion of that small remnant is going to come back into the Promised Land during the time of the Persians, and they are going to be part of the seed stock that restarts the Israeli nation, and it will be to that nation that the Messiah comes. And those who put their trust in him will be redeemed for eternity, and they will be part of the future story of Israel, the eternal story of Israel. Verse 10, they shall go after he who is. He will roar like a lion, and when he roars, his children shall come trembling from the west. So here is the prophecy about the future. Now, some people think this is a reference to the return out of exile into the Promised Land, getting ready for the Messianic story. And there's probably some truth to that. But I think ultimately, this is the story of what will happen when the trumpet is sounded and Jesus appears in the sky and all the righteous are resurrected and transformed, and they are gathered together to the Middle East, to Jerusalem, to Jesus, where he will establish his eternal reign, starting with the millennium and then going into eternity. Because some of the elements in this passage here are similar to elements in millennial passages elsewhere. We're soon going to be in the prophecies of Isaiah. He's contemporary with the last part of Hosea. And so this, I believe, might be one of those millennial passages. Verse 11, they shall come trembling like birds from Egypt and like doves from the land of Assyria. When we talk about the highway of holiness later, it will come out of Egypt and out of Assyria to Jerusalem. And that highway of holiness is clearly a millennial passage. So I will return them to their homes, declares he who is. Ephraim has surrounded me with lies and the house of Israel with deceit, but Judah still walks with God and is faithful to the Holy One. So Judah comes up again, this time in a positive light, that Ephraim is being very bad and is coming under judgment. But Judah is still living, for the most part, according to the covenant. And so they're going to be spared the judgment coming in the form of the Assyrians. Chapter 12 starts off this way. Ephraim feeds on the wind and pursues the east wind all day long. They multiply falsehood and violence. They make a covenant with Assyria, and oil is carried to Egypt. So northern Israel, as we know, has entered into a tributary stature or status with Assyria. They've paid them 1,000 talents. They've given a third of a year's wages from each of the families in order to have this relationship with Assyria. And apparently they're also doing something similar with Egypt. But they're going to come under God's judgment and be taken away. But eventually, and this is where I want us to end today, eventually, through the new covenant, some of the people of those lines, those genetic lines, will come back to life and be gathered to this very promised land where they will live forever in the presence of the one who loved them and gave himself up for them. So this is part of the idea that God loves Israel and he wants what's best for them. And when we come back next week, we'll pick up that idea and that story in Hosea 12:2.